Welcome to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is David Shaman. David is a former World Bank insider. He has a brand new book out titled The World Bank Unveiled, Inside the Revolutionary Struggle for Transparency. The book documents his experiences inside the bank. He wants a more open and accountable institution. And he wrote it in his words because there is a startling difference between the rhetoric the bank uses and the reality of how it acts. And I can only add a couple of exclamation points myself because I am not a big fan of the World Bank. David thinks it can be reformed. I am a skeptic, but I'm very eager to hear what his feelings are and how he thinks we can do it. So, David, I welcome you to the program. We're not connected yet? Okay, we're still trying to get him. Who's on, David?
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Oh, I am fine. I'm delighted to have you on. I just introduced you.
Okay.
And I explained your new book, The World Bank Unveiled, Inside the Revolutionary Struggle for Transparency. And as a former insider, you know what goes on, having been there for a decade or so. And you believe the bank can be reformed. You remember in emails that we exchanged a few weeks back. I am a skeptic. I absolutely am a skeptic. I know the way the bank has operated since it was instituted. Well, I forget the original. What was the Bank for Reconstruction and Development? Was that the original name?
That's right. That was the original name. It was formed in 1944 when a number of countries led by the United States and the United Kingdom put together a proposal to have, I guess, a bank for reconstruction for the reconstruction of Europe in the aftermath of World War II. The main focus was actually on stabilizing currencies, which was the forerunner of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund.
And that was the original purpose of the IMF and how things have changed since then. When the original purpose no longer is relevant, what do, David? They invent a new purpose, right?
Well, actually, with regards to the bank, the original intent was actually had two intents. One was to stabilize Europe in the aftermath of World War II, but also was to provide development. The main component, really, the main focus was on Europe. But when the Marshall Plan was implemented in 1947, then the bank had to sort of do a switch of prerogatives, and they started focusing on development. Because in the aftermath of World War II, it was realized that the bank didn't have the financial resources to do effective reconstruction of Europe, and so that objective was actually taken over by the U.S. government.
Would you agree with me that my view is that the Marshall Plan, which is probably the best-known example of so-called U.S. Humanitarian foreign aid, my view all along has been that what the Marshall Plan was really about was not humanitarian aid, but keeping Western European countries from World War II from going communist. Because people were desperate unless they got the kind of help that they needed. My God, I mean, cities were destroyed. People were really in terrible straits. They needed help. And it made these countries very vulnerable to whatever another ideology would preach. But that music means a commercial break, David. Let's take that, come back, and we can continue on this point.
Okay, super. Thanks.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back. On with David Shaman talking about his new book on the World Bank, called The World Bank Unveiled. David, I honestly believe that the U.S., at least post-World War II, has never given a dime in humanitarian aid. There's a situation going on in Haiti right now that obsesses me. I just put out my 7th article this morning on it. 20,000 U.S. combat troops showing up in the country. They haven't lifted a finger to help Haitians who are absolutely desperate, starving to death. We had the European situation after World War II, when there really was the possibility that countries like Italy and I think Greece and who knows what other ones could have been very vulnerable to shifting away from the West and going to the East because they were in such desperate straits. And today, the foreign aid that the U.S. gives, virtually all of it is military aid, Israel getting by far the most. I think second. These are the big ones, are Egypt, Colombia, which is a narco state, militarized with the U.S. having access to every military base in the country and building new ones. Turkey, this is all for military purposes. It has nothing to do with humanitarian aid. And I think that's pretty much the way it's been since World War II. Now that's aside from the World Bank.
Sure, sure.
But the World Bank was for development, and in my feeling, the development was not to help ordinary people. The result was to have corporations making lots of money be able to make even more money. But you were there, and I wasn't. So you can tell me things I absolutely don't know.
Well, I guess we're talking about two different things. One is foreign assistance from the United States, and that's one thing. And the other thing is the objectives of the World Bank. With regards to foreign assistance by the U.S. or by any country, I think there are a couple of objectives. One is for political purposes, to propagate positions or policies that in the best interests of those countries. So I think the Marshall Plan did have a political agenda to stem the tide of communism after the finish of World War II. But I also think it had humanitarian purpose and reconstruction of Europe to, these were our, in many ways, these were our friends and our neighbors and our allies during the war. So, there was a wholesale devastation of the continent after the war. And I think, definitely, I think one of the objectives was humanitarian, but certainly one of the objectives was political. And countries such as even Germany and France had some vulnerabilities with the communists or with communism following the war. So I think there were a whole host of countries that were up in the air, and Italy and Greece are included in that bunch. So I think there are a number of objectives, and we shouldn't preclude one or the other, but certainly I think your view has legitimacy.
Well, America, I would also make the statement that ever since the country was born, America has been an imperial country, and I actually quoted George Washington a couple of times. I'm pretty much saying that. Pretty much saying that. You know, when we simply had our enclaves in the northeast of the country, and old George, he had much bigger aims than just the colonies back in those days. And it's gone on progressively, moving south and then coast to coast, ocean to ocean, and then taking half of Mexico and going abroad. And it's been a lovely history that we have, David.
Well, the U.S. is an ambitious country. I don't think anybody would refute that or doubt that. But and sometimes ambition's good, but sometimes it can overstep its bounds. I think the age of imperialism was an overstepping of bounds, and the U.S. wasn't the only culprit in that. And I think anytime you have military conflicts between wars, there are certain imperial objectives that often come to the forefront, and that includes current times as well. So,
look at what's going on right now. I mean, we illegally are fighting wars and occupying Iraq, Afghanistan. The situation in Haiti again, the proxy wars that we fight, Somalia is one, elsewhere in Africa. The Colombia militarization, it's got Latin American countries terrified. What the heck does America have in mind? Are they going to attack us? I mean, this just goes on all the time. So it's a serious situation. Obama just proposed his biggest military budget in the history of the country, over $700 billion. And that excludes all the black budgets, all the supplementals, Homeland Security. You roll it all up into a package, and we're spending well over $1 trillion annually, and Homeland needs go begging when they really desperately need it because the economic situation is terrible. Well, I guess the World Bank doesn't do anything to improve the Homeland situation. But what has it ever done to improve the lot of ordinary people in any country, any place? If it has, I don't know.
Well, I think just from my perspective, which is one person perspective, I think the bank does do good in the world. I mean, it's not a perfect institution. About a billion and a half people live in abject poverty today, and the World Bank is the most important international agency dedicated to reducing poverty. And I think the bank has a very noble mission. I think it has very dedicated staff. I think it has important strengths. I also think it has important weaknesses, and my book, The World Bank Unveiled, is a study about the bank from an internal perspective. Now, granted, it's one person's perspective, but I think it comes with a lot of legitimacy. I spent 12 years at the bank working there from, and so I was able to see the way the bank thinks, the way it acts, its perspective on a daily basis. And so I think that there's a lot of good people there. I think there's a lot of important strengths, as I mentioned, but important weaknesses, and those weaknesses include a monolithic culture that hoards information as opposed to disseminates knowledge, an institution that has accountability mechanisms that have loopholes in it, an institution that has structural inefficiencies that decrease its efficiency. And these were my perspectives from both my experiences trying to implement transparency initiatives at the bank, but also from my research. And, I think that, the mission is noble, but like all large bureaucracies, there are certain inefficiencies that prevent the institution from being more effective. And the bottom line is how it reduces poverty. I think it's had some successes, but it's also had some important failures. And I'm not the expert on analyzing successes and failures. There's plenty of those folks around the international development field, and their voices are a lot more weighty than mine. But my view is really about the culture of the institution, analyzing how that culture works and why it's effective or ineffective.
David, some of the things that concern me are an American always runs the bank, just like a Western European always runs the IMF, and the current president, I think, is Robert Zeller.
Zelik,
I'm sorry.
Yep.
A hardline neocon of the Bush administration. He was the Bush administration's trade representative, I think. But, this is a guy way over on the fringe of the right. He personally, based on what he did in the Bush administration, simply doesn't give a damn about ordinary people, just the opposite. You've got strings attached when they invest money in a country. The things that can be so counterproductive to people who need the most help, ordinary people, impoverished people, structural adjustments, privatizing, same as the IMF, privatizing state industries, cutting social services, cutting wages. How on earth does this help ordinary people?
Well, I think there's a lot of controversy about some of the lending conditions that the bank has imposed. My theory goes somewhat like the following. I think that in the post-9/11 period, development practitioners who believe that the root causes of terrorism are poverty. Not everybody believes that, but a significant percentage of the development community thinks that way. And so consequently, reducing poverty is critical to ending the war on terrorism, But in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in 2001, development aid from major donors has not been forthcoming. Now, in 2002, in Monterrey, the richest countries of the world got together and pledged that they would donate 0.7 of their GDP to development assistance. And then again, in 2005, in Gleneagles, Scotland, the G8 got together and said, well, we'll donate $150 billion of aid to Africa. Most of it to sub-Saharan Africa. And in fact, in 2008, the New York Times came out with some research that aid levels had not increased, but in fact had declined. And, that of these richest countries that had made the pledge to, donate 0.7 of their GDP, in fact, 0.28 had been donated, and the most egregious of those folks was the U.S. at 0.16. Sounds like you have a commercial coming, but I have a few more thoughts on this.
We'll pick it up when we come back. Indeed, the U.S. seems to be the richest country in the world, is the biggest offender. Not good stuff, but we'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. On with David Shaman, talking about his new book, The World Bank Unveiled, Inside the Revolutionary Struggle for Transparency. David, let me let you pick up where we left off.
Sure. Well, the reason I mentioned that the aid levels from the richest countries, the U.S., the Western Europeans, Japan, had failed to live up to their stated commitments, the World Bank, as the key and the most important development lending institution, really has the lead role in convincing these donors to live up to their commitments. And in the 7 years following the terrorist attacks in 2001, the bank was really an ineffective advocate, and they were not able to convince the donors to live up to their commitments. As a result, we now have 1.5 billion people who live in abject poverty, and the Millennium Development Goals, which are key targets that the UN codified along with its member countries of targets to reduce development by 2015. Most experts believe that the Millennium Development Goals, MDGs, will not be met by 2015, key ones in key areas such as Africa. I think that my theory is that there's three basic reasons why the bank was not an effective advocate from 2001 to 2008. And 2008 is a key turning point here. The reason why the bank was not effective was that donor countries were, and I think still remain, skeptical about the bank's lending, whether the lending is effective. There's been a number of development think tanks and economists and NGOs who have questioned the lending effectiveness of the institution and have provided analysis suggesting important shortcomings. And since the terrorist attacks, donors have promised to increase aid levels, but in fact they're devoting most of their resources into fighting the war on terrorism instead of the war on global poverty. So I think one reason is that donors don't believe that the bank is an effective lender, and so if the bank is not an effective lender, then the bank can't justifiably go to the donors and say increase development assistance. The second reason goes back to your question, that borrowing countries have found and continue to find that the bank's lending conditions are stringent, draconian, and often creating unnecessary hardships on their populations. Conditions such as structural adjustment lending, which you mentioned, has forced poor countries to reduce their public spending, increase their savings, reduce inflation. And while these may be sound macroeconomic policies, they often belie the political realities facing many developing countries, and they also reduce the safety nets for the poorer populations in these countries. So as a result, borrowers have increasingly shied away from the bank and turned to private capital financing for their development needs. And concurrently, this has led to a hemorrhaging of the bank's portfolio, both with emerging market countries and developing economies. And so much of the bank's focus has been on these middle-income countries, the big ones, the Chinas, the Brazils, the Indias. And alternatively, these countries also have more options in private markets for their financing of projects. This has sort of led to a concurrent weakening of the bank's influence over its client countries. The third reason, which is really the focus of my book, is that shareholders, donors and the borrower members of the bank, and stakeholders such as NGOs and community-based organizations and private citizens view the bank as a monolithic society where well-connected financiers close their doors to debate the economic fate of millions. And once those decisions have been made, those doors open up and the bank and the IMF sort of tell the poor people of the world what they've decided to do. And so the critics accuse the bank of having a culture of secrecy, an aversion of transparency, and a lack of accountability. And as a result, they hesitate to trust the bank. And the moral standing of the institution is weakened, and its ability to advocate for policies it supports has deteriorated. So that takes us to 2008. And then in 2008, we had the global financial downturn, which was critical in two important developments occurred. The first, by all estimates, including the banks and the UN and a number of other international organizations, millions and millions of people are returning back to abject poverty because of the global economic downturn. Some estimates have 100 million people going back into severe poverty. The second important development is that because of the crisis, the rich and the middle-income countries of the world don't really have any alternatives to provide development assistance except through the international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank. And so as a result, they're pumping billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. In April of 2009, the G20, which is a coalition of the G8, the richest countries of the world, plus the most powerful middle-income countries of the world, such as China, Brazil, India, and whatnot. They got together in London and pledged $1.1 trillion in development assistance to help developing countries get through this current economic downturn. So the result is the World Bank, which has had billions and billions of dollars pumped into it by the G20, plus its own existing financial resources, is now back on center stage. Even though they were ineffective for the better part of a decade, this past decade, they're now back at center stage, more powerful, and with more financial resources than ever. My question is, moving forward, will they be any more effective than they have been in the past?
Well, I have a clear answer than that. To that question, David, let's take a break and I'll give you my answer and then I want to hear yours.
Okay.
Quick break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
With David Chaiman talking about his new book on the World Bank. David, knowing what I do about the IMF's history and the damage it's done for so many decades, it seems very clear to me that what the IMF is all about, which is really what the U.S. primarily is all about, is entrapping indebted nations in permanent debt bondage and making them need to continually borrow more simply to service the debt. So you reach a point where there is no possibility of getting out from under it unless you default, And, of course, it comes with all the usual strains, you know, cutting social services and wages and privatizing everything and so on, which is absolutely terrible. A country like Iceland is literally being stripped to the bone, like a human body, literally having all the flesh stripped off of it and leaving nothing but bone and sinew. That's what's going on in Iceland right now. That's what's going on to a lesser extent, but well advanced in countries like the Ukraine. The reason a new president was just elected, whether he'll surrender to the usual interests or not, who knows? It's going on in other Eastern European countries, Latvia. It's going on in Greece. The worst thing Greece could do, in my mind, is get entrapped in the IMF. Countries that went through it and became prosperous and managed to get out from under the IMF, especially Latin American countries, they want nothing to do with the IMF ever again. And I must say, they don't want anything to do with the World Bank, because they felt that the World Bank exploited them as well. These institutions could be wonderful, David, but the history that I know shows just the opposite.
Well, I think that there's certainly a certain percentage of folks who feel exactly the way you do. My perspective is, that there's, I don't know that much about the IMF, so I can't really speak about them. But as far as the bank's concerned, I know from my own personal experiences, there's a lot of good people there. There's a lot of dedicated people. Does the institution make mistakes? I think it does. And have there been some inequities? I think there have. I think there's been a number of books and research that documented quite clearly. Mortgaging the Earth was a book that was written in the early 1990s by Bruce Rich, who talked about the environmental activities of the bank. It's not very flattering. Another recent book came out called The Gods of Lending by Steve Berkman, and it talks about the operational aspects of the bank and how if it didn't foster corruption, it certainly turned its head the other way in its lending operations. So I think those are very tough books about the bank that offer some perspectives that are similar to what you've suggested. My perspective is that there's cultural aspects of the bank that make it very difficult for the institution to be more effective. But I want to pick up on the point where we left off about the where we are now as in the in 2010 as the global economic downturn continues. And I think the bank is it's in a very interesting place, and that place is that the G20 has pumped billions of dollars into the bank to help poor countries through the global crisis. And so the political pressures from the G20 are very intense that the bank must be successful. And it also must be that the institution also must be successful on a humanitarian level, because, 1.5 billion people in poverty is an astronomical amount of people who live in on the fringes of society. So I think the political and humanitarian pressures are great. And what's interesting is that for a number of years, folks outside the bank, external observers, critics, development NGOs, development think tanks, individuals, have been putting a lot of pressure on the bank to reform, to change its ways, to change the way it works. And the bank has resisted. Its culture is like a glacier. It moves incrementally, very slowly. And it's resisted changing. But now, in the last year or so, it's put together a couple of commissions to review how it does public information disclosure and to review how it does its internal governance. And about a month ago, the bank issued new policies on information disclosure, that is, the releasing of documents to the public for its scrutiny. And it takes some important steps forward, so that's a positive thing. I don't think it goes as far as it could go, which is making public access to the board of executive directors of the bank, their meetings, which are pivotal in the bank's decision-making process. It doesn't go far enough in making that type of information open. But I think it's important because in April of this year, when the bank convenes its annual meetings in Washington, it's expected that they'll announce what type of reforms they've accepted what type of reforms they're going to implement on its internal governance. And I think this is important. In October of this past year, 2009, about a year earlier, the bank formed a commission, an external commission, to review its internal governance. And that commission was led by former Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo. And the Zedillo Commission came out with a report in October of 2009 that suggested a number of reforms. And they're good reforms. I also think that they don't go far enough.
Can I throw one thing in?
Sure, of course.
If Zedillo was such a reformist, why were his policies when he was president of Mexico exactly the opposite?
Well, you know, I can't speak for his time in Mexico. I mean, I wouldn't speak with any authority there. But, I mean, he led the commission. It wasn't, he didn't do the report by himself. So he had a whole host of other folks that were part of the commission that came out with this report.
He was skilled to be able to do it. He was a skilled, trained technocrat. So this is a man that I think is erudite, and I think he understands the situation very well. So I think he very well could be a very competent guy to come up with whatever he was involved in.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, you know, the Zedillo Commission came out with its findings, and there were some new things there. But I think the basic reform objectives of both the commission, the Zedillo Commission, and a number of other development think tanks and NGOs and individual practitioners kind of focuses on four basic changes for the bank. And the four basic changes that folks are advocating out there include changing the composition and the size of the board of directors, as well as increasing their expertise on the bank's operational affairs. Another one is increasing public access to board meetings and documents. I mentioned that just a bit ago. A third one is giving emerging and developing country members a greater voice and vote power in the operational decisions of the bank. And the final change is something that you alluded to with regards to Robert Zoellick, but that the selection process of future bank presidents is more open and more merit-based, meaning that it's not a fait accompli that the U.S. government chooses the new bank presidents moving forward, and that it could be the most qualified candidate. So those are the reforms that most folks are advocating. I think they're very positive reforms. I think they'll make some good changes, but I'm not sure that they're actually enough because based on my experiences, the reforms that I just mentioned will target the upper echelon of the institution's political framework, and the policy decisions may be orchestrated from that level, but they're actually implemented further below at the mid-level managerial core. And here, I think it's important to sort of look at the key structural inefficiency of the bank. And it goes somewhat as follows. Senior management the bank is basically made up of three layers. One is senior management, one is mid-level management, and then there's staff. And senior management, they sculpt the visionary reforms, the visionary decisions to address or reduce the geopolitical pressures that are brought upon the institution by both member countries, external watchdogs, the media, and also the ever-evolving business and financial environment. And so as these external pressures have grown, the information revolution has heightened and reduced the time that the senior officials have to react. The interconnectivity of the global economy has reduced the time that the senior officials have to react. And so what this has evolved into is that senior management, because they're genuflecting to these external pressures, they're constantly reorganizing the bank. I mean, over the last quarter century, the bank has a history of almost continual reorganizations. But to implement their reforms or implement their new policies, senior officials, they don't have the time or the expertise to go into individual divisions and individual units and manage them effectively. They must rely on the mid-level managerial core. And the mid-level managerial core is really, in reality, a series of fiefdoms. So the way things are managed, the way decisions are actually implemented, not decided upon, but implemented, are through these fiefdoms in the mid-level management. And here we start to talk about the culture of the institution. And the culture of the institution, it's subservient to those above, it's conservative, it adheres to the status quo, and maintaining the status quo is really a strategy for advancement and accruing power. And a place like the bank, accruing power means eventually managing thousands of staff, managing billions of dollars of budget, managing the economic policies of countries and even global regions. So there's a lot of power to be had by moving up the ranks of an institution like the World Bank. So the question becomes, if loyalty is a key barometer for advancement, why wouldn't mid-level managers implement exactly the type of directives that senior officials request? And I think the answer can be found in the fact that the bank is constantly reorganizing. And has been doing that for years. And so as senior managers are genuflecting to the pressures brought upon it by external forces, they're moving in one direction, they're moving in another direction, and if a mid-level manager, starts implementing the latest strategy and then gets caught too far down the road in one direction, and then the big strategy shifts in another direction, well, then he's caught in a very lonely spot. And so the safest place for mid-level managers who are controlling these fiefdoms is really to do very little to reinforce the status quo. So you really have top level management is moving back and forth, and mid-level management is staying in one place, and that creates a lot of frictions and a lot of inefficiencies, a lot of information warps, and a lot of hesitation to actually do things that are efficient and effective for the mission, which is reducing poverty.
Let me throw in one thing, if I may, David.
Sure.
The reforms you mentioned sound good if there really is a sincere effort to implement them. But to me, the biggest thing of all isn't included in the ones you mentioned. What will the bank's policies be going forward, and how will they be different from ones in the past that never helped the people who need the help the most? Apparently, those reforms aren't being considered. So if that's true, then what good will transparency be if bad policies are part of the way the bank operates? That's my key point.
Well, you know, as I mentioned, and I talk about this at length in the book, which is that these reforms, I think they're positive reforms, and I don't have any criticism of the reforms that have been laid out by others. But I'm not sure they're the right reforms for changing the way the bank actually works. And I think there's a number of things that the bank can do, but it will be difficult because you have to change the internal culture, and changing an organization's culture is probably the most difficult thing a reform or a change advocate
can do.
Oh,
amen.
But I think I've identified a number of things that are possible. The bank has a series of internal accountability mechanisms. One is the independent evaluation group. They evaluate the bank's lending projects, whether they're effective or ineffective. There's the inspection panel that reviews whether the bank is adhering to its own policies in its operational activities. There's the conflict resolution system, which is where staff who may have grievances with managers can utilize that system to address their grievances. And these internal accountability mechanisms are all positive, but they all have a really important flaw in it, that is that they are managed internally by the bank. And it's impossible for any organization, and this is not a critique of the bank specifically, but it's impossible for any organization to be the judge and jury of an accountability mechanism. It creates an inherent conflict of interest. And so, you know, if the bank is, you know, judge and jury and something unpleasant comes up, it can mitigate the effects or the bad outcomes of what may happen, if there's some controversy. So the one thing that I think would be an important reform would be to move these accountability mechanisms to external sources. So they would be independent of the bank. They could provide objective evaluations of the problems that or the processes that the bank employs. I think these reforms would be very powerful, and I think they would have very positive outcomes. However, the bank's management has fiercely resisted that concept in the past because keeping control of the allows management to muffle problems before they become public. So I think that would be one important reform. And there's a number of other reforms that I think that would also be important, and you know, I could talk at length about them as well.
Well, a big one I would like to see would be to shove America more to the sidelines and put more in on center stage. Countries that never have a say about any of these major things. Countries affected by World Bank policies. In my mind, David, the countries affected are the ones that I think should have at least equal say over how the bank is run, not necessarily to be the authority over the bank or any other world institution. But if they're affected by bank policies, how can you leave them out of the picture? But, of course, with America having a stranglehold on bank policy, in my mind, I scratch my head and I say, under that kind of a system, how on earth can any constructive change happen? I just have a hard time imagining it.
Well, you know, I think that that is a perspective that a lot of folks have, and that's one of the reforms that I mentioned has been discussed by external folks about changing the voice and the vote representation to push more provide developing countries, poorer countries, middle-income countries, a greater say in the bank's activities.
David, one more break. A final segment. We could keep this going easily for another hour, I guarantee
sure.
you.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Final segment with David Shaman. His book titled The World Bank Unveiled, Inside the Revolutionary Struggle for Transparency. David, one quick comment and then I'll let you wrap up. An example that I've discussed many, many times in this program with very distinguished, brilliant economists, and they make no bones about it. They basically all agree with each other. Some discuss at one point a little more, a little less, whatever. But the policies, just take the policies in this country under the Treasury, under the Federal Reserve, the policies have been exactly the opposite of what's needed to fix the grave and growing economic crisis we face. Economist Michael Hudson, he has a wonderful phrase I wish I thought of in describing Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman. He calls him a useful idiot, a man who obviously never took a basic course in economics because he knows nothing about basic economics. His policies are exactly the opposite of what classical economics teaches us works. And his policies, we understand, don't work. Now, when you throw trillions of dollars at a problem, you'll bury it for a while. You'll keep things levitating. You'll make the stock market go up. But when you have an enormous debt crisis, how on earth do you fix it? By piling on more debt. It's like taking a fire and throwing gasoline on it. Mm-hmm. So down the road, we're heading for a calamity much greater than the one we've been going through for the past couple of years. I fear that the IMF and the World Bank are doing similar things, not the same things, but similar things on a world basis, the countries they get involved with. But correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, you know, Steve, I'm not an economist, and, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment on economic policies of the Fed or anybody else, including the World Bank. But I'm a reform agent and my with a focus on the World Bank, and I think the reforms that I discussed in the book and previously would make a big impact on how the bank works and make a big impact both on its operational activities but also its policies. And since, you know, we're running out of time, I thought I'd mention a couple more reforms that I think would be very powerful in changing the way the bank operates. I mentioned taking the accountability mechanisms outside of the bank to independent external organizations that could monitor the bank more objectively than the bank could do for itself. But another, several other important reforms include the following. I would change the, I would revise the managerial selection process of the bank. The bank recruits and promotes a lot of technicians and folks with, tremendous academic excellence. But it really, doesn't have a lot of folks who are good at, leadership or have entrepreneurial or innovative skills. And I would, look to change the way the bank selects people for its managerial positions, to incorporate folks who have a lot more real-life experiences, a lot more leadership qualities. Another reform, I think it's a bit of an unorthodox one, but I think it would have a lot of an important effect on the bank, would be to include a civil society representative on the board of executive directors. That would increase civil society's inclusion and participation in the bank's policymaking, as well as reduce and depoliticize NGO criticisms of the institution. There's some political issues with that, and I talk about that in other ways. Another reform would be to change the World Bank Institute, a pedagogical arm of the institution, from one that imposes institutional viewpoints to one that practices an open learning model that allows the variety of viewpoints.
I got to cut you off. They're going to cut me off.
Oh, okay.
Well, the music means they're going to segue to the next program.
All right. If folks want to know more, then they can visit worldbankunveiled.com. That's my website. It has a lot more information.
And if they forget that, they can email me and I will tell them. David, I thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, I hope your book sells a lot of copies, and it should, because we need all the phones we can get.
Well, I think the important thing is to get folks thinking and talking about what would be important to help them.
Oh, absolutely. Stay tuned for Ernie Hancock, and join us again tomorrow.